Accession number 7242, reel number 2.
Mr. Kitty, reel 2.
Now, when we first went to the Corinne area, we were in the foothills adjacent to Corinne and Fort Dolagadorock, in a valley to the south. I see it's marked on the map as Happy Valley, but I don't have any recollection of it being called Happy Valley in those days.
And where could you be fired at from the Italian positions?
Not in the early days, and certainly not where I was, Battalion Order Room area. No way could we be fired on from there, except artillery, but they had better targets nearer to them. Troop concentrations a lot nearer than we were, than I was.
Why couldn't they fire on you? Because you were too far away?
Yes, I was in what was called B Echelon at that time, which was the admin area. Casualty lists were sent down daily from the companies and put on to part two orders, you know, for transmission to England. And that was basically my job at that time.
Could you actually see the Italian positions from where you are?
Only by the virtue of the fact that we knew what we were after capturing. And we weren't miles away. We could see the positions, but we couldn't see the men walking about on them. We could see gun smoke and artillery smoke, and as were our troops were mortaring, we could see mortar smoke, and we could see the bombs dropping when our people went in to bomb the tops of the mountains where the Italian troops were entrenched.
Did you have aircraft support?
We had the aircraft support at that time, yes.
Was this the first time in the campaign that you'd had it?
I have no recollection of it in the Galabat area, none whatever. But I do well remember that we had bombers coming up from the Khartoum area daily, because I have seen them being chased back with the fighters on the tail.
Did you see any shot down?
No, I saw one which I was sure would get shot down. He was getting peppered pretty badly with an Italian fighter on his tail. It was old bombers. There was nothing modern about them. They were old things, and they had no great turn of speed. And we did see them getting peppered on the way back, and we never seemed to get much news as to whether they'd reach base or not.
Were they RAF?
Yes, they were RAF. But they were flying old kites. They weren't. They had nothing modern.
Do you know if their bombing was effective at all?
I didn't hear any complaints about bombing our own troops, which we got a lot of later on in the war. We did get some good results from them, I think, at that time. I don't recollect any complaints. They seemed to be hitting the Italians as opposed to hitting us.
How did your unit go about attacking the Italian positions?
It was hill climbing, the pinnacle, and which where the Dolagadorock fort was, the pinnacle. I think they were the two that our battalion were mostly interested in. And the attacking companies A, B, and C were climbing at night and holding up during the day. And at night they were being watered and fed and ammunition by D Company under Sergeant Major Maloney, I think it was at that time.
How difficult was it for them to scale these peaks?
It was really hard work. I went up one night, because even though you were employed on admin duties, they were combing the rear area for people to assist. Some people had to get rested, some people had to get medical treatment, And I went up one night with a chap called Gastineau, who was... he came from Hull. And there was mortaring, or hand grenades, and I do remember that Gastineau dashed into a... what he thought was a place of safety, and one of the Cypriot mules kicked him and broke both his legs. So that was his first and last appearance on the Mount Carin. Went down as wounded in action. He was put down kindly, I thought, as a wounded in action. But he was in action, of course. He was wounded by a mule.
Was this mortar fire which the porters were subjected to?
Yes, mortar fire and grenades. Mostly grenades. You see, at the top of the hill it was quite easy to lob grenades over at night. And the porters were subjected to a certain amount of that kind of treatment.
But all the actual loads were carried by mules, were they?
They were mules to a certain height. And then you couldn't persuade them to go any further when the mortaring started. But they did carry it across the valley into a probably a few hundred feet, and then it was all manpower after that.
So then you had to put the loads on your head, did you?
On the backs. Well, the natives put them on their heads. We put them on our backs.
Did they have straps on or something?
Straps, yes. It was they weren't killing loads, but... You can't break jerry cans of water down, and they're pretty heavy when you're climbing and in rocks. The going wasn't easy.
About how heavy would the loads each have been?
I have no recollection of what the loads were, you know, weight-wise.
Could you actually see the Italians when you were... being subjected to the grenades?
No, this was at night, and the visibility was, well, practically zero. But they were lobbing grenades in the direction of sound, as opposed to silhouettes or seen targets. But you've got to say, though, that you can't compare an Italian grenade with a Mills grenade. It was a puny little thing. It didn't splinter on impact like the Mills grenade. It was a large steel ball, what do they call them? Like a big steel marble. Ball steel. Bearing, like a big steel ball bearing, about an inch in diameter, enclosed in cheap tin and a percussion cap. And they threw that down, and if the steel thing missed you, you were all right, but with a Mills grenade, of course, you'd have probably had it. I know one chap who, later on in the war, he got a direct hit with one of these Italian grenades on his gas match, which we carried on the chest, and no harm at all, whereas he would have been in pieces with one of our grenades that hit him there.
Did you go up again with any loads?
No, I went one night, and I wasn't called upon after that.
How long did it take to go up there and come back?
As far as I recollect, we were back about from 10 o'clock at night till about 3 o'clock in the morning, and then that was it.
So you got back by night before daybreak?
Oh, yes, long before daybreak.
When you got to the troops you were supplying, what appearance did their positions have?
They were just scooped out areas, and you couldn't dig. You'd just level it, and clear all the rocks off the area, and then put rocks in front of you, and get behind them and hope for the best. There was no shelter for them during the day from the sun and the heat, and there wasn't a lot of shelter from snipers because the adjacent peaks were held by the... Italian troops, and our troops were subjected to a lot of sniping, and because they were on the lower peaks, they hadn't got the one that mattered then, which was the fort, Dolagodorok.
Did you have to evacuate wounded as well?
Oh yes, wounded were being brought out, wounded and sick were being brought out each night.
But did they go back with the porters?
A lot of them, yes. Walking wounded came back with the porters. Then we had stretcher bearers, of course, there all the time, which weren't part of the porter company.
What type of wounds did the people you evacuate have?
Artillery, shrapnel. No, shrapnel wounds, a lot of them. Some gunfire wounds, GS. But, as I say, the grenade wounds were just non-existent. But it was a lot of shrapnel and mortar and rifle wounds. And of course we did get quite a few killed. I can't quote numbers at this stage, but we did have quite a lot of casualties in the battalion.
Were the dead brought down, or were they buried on the hillside?
No, brought down eventually.
How did the attack on Fort Dolagadora proceed?
It was, I can't remember the number of days it took, but eventually our battalion, the 2nd Battalion, did make their way into it. And what was more important, they held it. There was a lot of counter-attacks. But they were always in good heart against the Italians. They didn't seem to rate them very highly. And they did manage to hold on. But I did hear a story that when our battalion first went into the fort, there was a dead Cameronian in the fort. They spoke about him quite a bit. So they had a foothold at some time of the Cameronians. I think they were, I'm not sure whether they were 4th or 5th in the division, but they definitely had a foothold in Dolagadora before our troops took it.
When you went up to the to supply the troops, what type of heart did they seem to be in?
They all seem to be fairly good heart. They can make a joke out of most things, British troops, and there weren't a lot of mourners in those days. We're a fairly young battalion, you know, age-wise, they were fairly young, and they were in good spirits.
Did any of the troops ever say, why are we here in East Africa?
I have a faint recollection of it, but it didn't create any discord. I think we were pep-talked when out of it when earlier on, when most of Europe had fallen. We had some good officers and we got good talks, and they used to compare the territory that Hitler had taken with the territory that Napoleon had years before in Europe, and he had far more, apparently, than Hitler ever took. And they said we were in a bit of trouble, but they didn't see any reason why we shouldn't fight our way out of it. We'd lost the first couple of three battles, but we'd win the war. And I think that was the whole outlook. We never rated the Italians. There were some good fighters among them at times, but never comparable to the Germans.
Did your officers ever tell you why the Italian campaign was necessary?
I don't remember any briefing. Africa belonged to the British as far as we were concerned, I think. They had pinched Abyssinia from the Italians in 36. And I think we just wanted them out. And I don't think we ever had any real strategic talks as to why we wanted... It became obvious after that the Suez Canal was imperiled, but the longer the Italians were, the more territory had, the worse chance we had of keeping the Suez intact. I thought that was the main reason, but I don't think we ever had any long discussions about it.
What did the troops find when they took Fort Dolagadora?
Quite a few dead eye ties and quite a few guns and things like that. But, as I say, I wasn't on the spot. I did come across a Sergeant Major later who had got his service pack full of money from a few cashiers' place, which they overran and helped themselves to. And he had lira then. I think he had millions as opposed to thousands. And he was giving it away in handfuls to various people.
Could you spend it?
Oh, yes, in Asmara, the rate of exchange was fixed so many lire to the pound, and it did seem fairly favourable to us, but I can't remember the exact number of lire at that time. But I don't know that this Sergeant Major got a lot, because I got a nice little handful myself given, and I spent that in Asmara.
How much did he give you?
Thousands of lire. Thousands.
Did the officers not attempt to take it off him?
I don't think so. It was common knowledge that he... because he invested it in jewellery, good class jewellery. He spent a lot of time in Asmara sorting out the jewellery in the shops, and easily carried jewellery, you know, with rings. And I remember one particular one he had. It was a beautiful ring with a watch inside it, you know, a little releasable top. When you opened it, there's a minute watch in it. The irony of that, of course, is that the Sergeant Major, with all his loot, he was caught by the Italians later on the desert, and he became a prisoner of war himself. So, I don't know, he'd be re-looted, wouldn't he?
What happened after the capture of Fort Dolgodoroc?
We went on then, moved along to... Asmara, but in between we took the surrender of the Duke of Aosta's troops. He asked for a surrender with honour, you know, the old type surrender with honour, and he was given it. British troops presented arms as the old Duke gave himself and his Italians up, and I think that may be of one of the last occasions when ceremonial surrender was accepted.
Did you see it?
I was not on that parade, no, but I do know that it happened.
Did you see many Italian prisoners?
Oh, yes. There was literally thousands of them in the compounds when we got to Asmara. Thousands of them. And... we settled down in Asmara to regroup and get sorted out physically, and started to retrain again. And that was when we did meet a few Italians of the, you know, the local pioneers, I should think they would call themselves, wouldn't they? In the colonial empire of Mussolini.
What was the general appearance of the Italian prisoners?
Scruffy. But everywhere I met Italians, they were scruffy. I think they were well fed at that time. I don't think the bite had started, you know, for rations. They would be living on the supplies they already had, I think, at that time, because they wouldn't be able to get much from Italy. But they didn't seem to be underfed or badly fed in any way.
In what way were they scruffy?
They were strangers to soap and water. They didn't... believe in personal hygiene to the same extent as the British troops, who had personal hygiene, whether they... I mean, it was imposed on you. You had to shave and wash every day. Conditions being favourable, you weren't allowed to grow beards and walk about in a dirty manner. Choose where you were, even when you were fighting.
Did you have enough water to be able to wash?
Yes, we weren't badly supplied with water. We were worse off later on the desert, a lot worse off. But I never remember any shortage of water in the lines of communication were close, you see. They weren't spread out like they were on the desert. And there was great rivers where you could draw water and purify it. And we never had any shortage of water. We could always keep a clean appearance and keep clean.
What was the morale of the Italian POWs?
They were a bit down. They were a long way from home, and they were captured, and they were definitely down. That brings to mind another thing. We had a fitter called... he had a little German dog, the little Daxie, and he lost it at the Battle of Karin. It disappeared. And weeks after, he was passing a prisoner of war compound in Asmara, and his dog was in the compound with an Italian officer. He'd got it when it took fright and crossed the lines. And I remember Hammond, they called the sergeant, he gave one whistle and he's reunited with his dog, which was rather nice.
How did the Italians show that they were down in spirits?
Well, the pretty hangdog lot, they looked. They didn't appear to have any morale or hope. I think they were a long way from home and they thought they were going to stay there for a long, long time. They weren't very cheerful at all.
Did they speak to you or approach you?
We weren't allowed much contact with them. They were in compounds and we got more contact with the civilians. There were civilians who weren't involved in the war, of course, in Asmara. And when we took the town over, we took it over and let the civilians get on with their job and we got on with ours. We were policing the town and things like that. There was a curfew. But they were allowed to run their stores and shops and little cafes. And they were awfully short of bread and chocolate for the kids and milk. And I got contact with a civilian family later on, a man and his wife and a little girl, and I used to take the little girl chocolate and jam when I could buy it. They hadn't much money, they were very hard up. And I think we'd been there about a fortnight, and on our part one orders, there was a notice published to the effect that the women and children in Asmara, the Italians, had no milk. And the Indian troops in our brigade had volunteered to give them a percentage of their daily ration. And it was to be hoped that we'd do the same. Well, of course we did. I just forget the percentage we gave to the... But it was diverted for the women and children, Italians, in Asmara. I think we were rather upset that we hadn't thought of it first. The white troops, as I say, there were three Indian battalions, and they'd thought of giving the kids the milk, and we couldn't do anything else. We had to give them ours, or a portion of it. I think it was well received.
What did the attitude of the Italian civilians seem to be towards you and towards the war?
They wanted no part of Mussolini, but I don't know whether that was a put-up job because they were... They'd just been crunched, which they had. And they were friendly to us. We were in the cafes and they always approached us. But then again, they had no cigarettes. And they approached us, could we sell them cigarettes? So whether the friendliness was of necessity or... you just can't think at this time. But I think they were definitely hard up and they wanted cigarettes from us. And I bought cigarettes from the canteen and took them to this Italian I knew. I bought jam for his wife and chocolate and bread for his child out of the canteens. I never had any trouble getting it out of barracks. Nobody ever said, where are you taking that? There was no restrictions on us selling the stuff to the Italians. We weren't profiteering, we were just friendly with them. Because I did go down and have spaghetti and meatballs with them on occasion and tried to learn a bit more of their language. And I've often thought since that I'd kept in touch with the De Santis, they call the man, Pasquale De Santis, and his little girl was Mariella. And I well remember the first time I took chocolate in for her. She knew what it was all right, a big scream of chocolata, as soon as she saw it.
How did the occupying troops behave in Asmara?
Well, there was a certain amount of drunkenness. I think it follows where troops are. They get cheap wines, and Chianti was very cheap. And they drink everything out of pint glasses, the troops, or pint mugs. They don't drinking little tots. If it's there, they drink it. And there was a certain amount of drunkenness. We had a few punished for theft. We even had one chap pinched a piano in Asmara. But he got it back to the sergeant's mess, but didn't stay there long before the provost marshal was round him. But it's British troops. They do steal and pilfer, same as any other troops. And there's no disguising the fact.
Was there any other stealing or looting?
Not a lot, because our CO was pretty good, pretty regimental and keen, and a bit of fighting among the coloured troops now and on when they got there be a few fisticuffs, but not to any great extent.
You mean between Indian
and British? British you do get it, yes. Well, Indians fighting Indian as well, and British fighting British. You know, they got a few drinks and let the hair down.
What were relations like between the Indians and the British?
Fairly good. Yeah, I thought very good. I don't remember any real animosity. A lot of the battalion that I was in had served in India before the war. They were regular soldiers, and a lot had knowledge of Indian conditions and Indian troops. And there was a fairly good rapport between the coloured troops and our troops.
What did the British troops think of the soldierly quality of the Indian troops?
I don't think we could fault it. They were good fighters. I mean, we were talking about Sikhs and Pathans and Garwals and people like that, and there's no doubt about it, they were good fighters. These, of course, were peacetime soldiers, peacetime trained, with esprit de corps, which we had. Later on, the troops from India couldn't be the same standard because they were being rushed through the mill training, coming into action long before they were fit to go in, because there was holes to plug, gaps to fill. And a lot of people put in, British troops as well, long before they were ready for action, just force of circumstances. But the lads we were with, the Indian troops we were with, they were pre-war soldiers, and they were good soldiers.
Between the capture of Fort Dolagodarok and Asmara, was there any fighting for the West Yorkshires?
I think there was a place called Amber Alagi. I think that was in between the two. But as I say, I think we went on in that order. Dolagodarok, Amber Alagi, Teclesham, and then at Teclesham, I think, and then into Asmara.
Can you describe the fighting at Amber Alagi?
No, I was never near enough. I went through Amber Alagi and Teclesham days after the troops had gone through, and any Italian households that we came across, I don't know if there was Italians who did it, but drawers were emptied and goods scattered about. They travelled light, and by the time I got there, whatever stuff had been in the households, any personal goods, it had been well picked over, and it looked as though there'd been a bit of looting. I should say they had.
What were relations like between the Italians and the Eritrean population?
Oh, very poor. They had no time for the Italians because they'd been exploited for years, hadn't they? For about 3 years or 4 years.
How did this show itself?
Just resentment. They couldn't pack in fast enough, couldn't the native troops? You know, the native levies. They always declined to fight. The Italian white troops fought on a bit longer, but the natives weren't keen.
Where did you go to after Asmara?
After Asmara, we stayed at Asmara until we embarked at Port Massawa, I think it was, Port Massawa, is it? Yes, in the Red Sea. And we went up to Port Tewfik on the Suez Canal and disembarked there for service on the desert. But that wasn't to be for some time because...